Next, I would like to introduce Kathy Kelly. She is the co-coordinator of Voices in the Wilderness, which is a campaign to end the sanctions in Iraq. Kathy Kelly.
Thank you. It's certainly a privilege to be here and to have heard Professor Marvel's very stirring words. In a way, I think what I need is just to go and meditate on that presentation for probably the rest of the evening. But anyway, I'm pleased that people are willing to indulge more thoughts coming from someone like me. The campaign to end the economic sanctions against Iraq has consumed much of my time, in part because when we started that campaign, there really weren't the teeming millions ready to jump in and join in on it. And so to a certain extent, I've been perhaps a little bit like Johnny One Note, but I would like to try to widen out my own thoughts tonight and perhaps start this discussion with you for the time that I have to pose the question, what can we reasonably expect the President of the United States to do? Now, wouldn't it be reasonable that we would expect a President of the United States to identify the major issues that we face and to work earnestly toward solving major problems we face? It seems to me unquestionably clear that a major problem we face on the planet and within the United States today is the problem of the energy crisis. We are facing the depletion of our resources, the terrible pollution of the planet, and the overconsumption of the world's resources represented by our one-sixth of the world's population that threatens the survival of the entire planet. Looking at those problems, the Republicans offer us two Texas oil men whose solution is to produce more American oil so we can consume more American oil. From the Democrats, we have Vice President Gore. I believe, as evidenced by his book, Earth in the Balance, he does understand that the energy crisis is a major crisis we all face. He even understands possible solutions. But Mr. Gore is indebted to Wall Street. His family fortune comes from the Occidental Petroleum Company. What evidence do we have that he'll actually work to solve these problems? What evidence do we have that he's actually already compromised? If you look at his track record and how well he avoids addressing these problems in his speeches, I don't think we find a credible candidate in Mr. Gore. Ralph Nader has shown his readiness, his willingness through a long history of addressing and identifying problems and looking to find solutions that he is a credible candidate to become President of the United States. And it's a privilege to be able to say that. I am someone who can speak personally about the effects of our current policy, particularly our so-called energy policy, on people in Iraq today. I've been back and forth to Iraq 12 times in the past 4 years. And I've seen the ruthlessness and the extent of ruthlessness to which the United States will go in order to maintain a status quo. I've seen some of the child victims of that policy, and I've learned to, whether I like it or not, state that the United States is currently practicing child sacrifice when over 500,000 children have died as a direct result of the economic sanctions against Iraq, as though we were ever going to hold children responsible for the actions of a government. And I have come back to the United States and heard the most incredible statements on the part of members of the Clinton cabinet, I suppose most chillingly, Madeleine Albright, saying that in advance of the Desert Fox bombing, she declared, "If we have to use force, we must. We are the indefensible nation. We stand taller than others. We see further." Well, if we stand taller than others at this point in human history, it might be just because we have starved the children of other people and they aren't able to grow to their full potential. I and others, including Amy Goodman, I hope she'll be able to join us tonight, can tell you stories that we believe are vastly underreported of what we've seen and heard in places like Haiti, in places like Indonesia, in places like East Timor, in places like Palestine, Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories, and in Iraq. And you aren't going to see or hear these stories in the mainstream media because we face the stranglehold on education created by not just a military-industrial complex, but a military-industrial congressional media complex. And the people at the heights of those four factors don't themselves want to know, and they don't want you to know, the effects of United States policies. They'll treat you and I with kid gloves here. We're treated with kid gloves. But the effects of these policies and of the Clinton-Gore administration's lawlessness and ruthlessness don't just apply a pinch to people in other countries. They apply a death-dealing wallop. May I tell you briefly a story from a 3-month stint that I spent in Haiti? I lived in Jeremy, in the southern finger of Haiti, in a desperately poor area. And, okay, with a balance to seeing desperate poverty is that you also see brilliant and wonderful young kids, and they don't know how bad their situation is yet. And every day, a little girl, Natasha, would just come speeding out, barreling out of her shack when I walked out the door of the place where I lived, and she'd give me a big hug, and it was a great way to start the day. One day, I walked out the door, and Natasha was kind of huddled, almost cowering off in a corner, and it was clear she didn't want to see me or be seen, and I began to gingerly walk toward her, wondering, did I say something to hurt her feelings? Had I done anything? And as I got closer, I saw beaming sun glistening on her lips, and in the sun's light I saw little tiny pebbles, and I realized that Natasha hadn't come running to see me because Natasha was eating dirt. No child should eat dirt. And the policies in the Clinton-Gore administration have allowed hundreds and thousands of children to die wretched deaths, bereft of anesthetics, bereft of antibiotics in Iraq, have allowed children to eat dirt in Haiti. And may I tell you just one more personal experience? I was spent a year in federal prison in the United States. Please don't think they can only get ex-cons to speak on Nader's behalf, but I went to jail for planting corn on a nuclear missile silo site. I'm proud. In that prison. And I haven't paid my taxes since 1980 because I won't pay for weapons either. In that prison, I would try to find a way to get a little quiet on a Saturday morning because prisons are not only the fruit of an infinitely stupid and backward and cruel policy, the so-called criminal justice policies, but they're also very, very noisy and overcrowded. And so on a Saturday morning, I'd wake up and I'd just try to get a little bit of time off to myself. And there was one room that you could go to that was virtually empty, except that also every Saturday morning, Gloria wanted a little time to herself. And so we'd both be in this room on a Saturday morning, I in a corner to read or study or write, and Gloria to always sign up for her phone call at that time of the morning. And she'd dial the phone, and then somebody would go and put the receiver in the earlobe of her tiny child. And Gloria would say, Mama's going to tickle your feet. Oh, baby, Mama loves you. Mama's going to tickle your feet. You Mama's baby. Mama's going to tickle your feet, baby. Mama can't wait to see you. Mama, come home, tickle your feet, baby. And then she'd hang up the phone, and she'd stand up with queenly elegance, tears streaming down her face, and she'd walk out of that room and the Saturday morning ritual was over, but she'd never tickle her baby's feet because she's separated from that baby by the prison industrial complex that has benefited a whole raft of lawyers who've been able to build their careers on locking up black women in America, on wardens who've benefited on the prison industrial complex, prison architects, a whole bunch of people are making money off of a policy that has waged war against women and children in the United States. You don't know, they don't want you to know, by and large. And yet, we are all part of one another.
And Ralph Nader knows. He doesn't run away from these issues. He doesn't want us to continue to say to people abroad, you're in our prison. We'll tell you how much you can earn and we'll tell you how you can spend it. He doesn't want to keep building a divide between people in this country. And he knows that the more that we create suffering and fear in other parts of the world, the more ultimately the national security here will be threatened, because ultimately people, I believe, will say, up with this, we will not put. And so I think of the wisdom of a group of teenage girls that I met in Iraq. They said to me, I am 16. Can you tell me the difference between me, I am 16, and someone who is 16 in your country? We will tell you, our emotions are frozen. We cannot feel. And then they went through some of the hardest of their experiences over the past year. And then one young girl stood up and she said, and can you tell me what would happen to us if we were to do to any other country in the world what is being done to us now? And we must examine that terrible, terrible double standard by which we who have invaded and occupied and overthrown governments in other parts of the world, we who have caused people in other parts of the world to not be able to produce their needed crops because we want them to produce the crops that we want to eat and consume, we whose economy is propped up on sales of weapons to other countries all around the earth, and by the way, to all the neighboring countries of Iraq, we who have developed, sold, stored, and used more weapons of mass destruction than any other country on earth, the very notion that we should have the credibility to dictate to other people how they should live their lives and organize their societies is unthinkable, and yet it is what the Clinton-Gore administration would hand to us and try to do so with great virtue. Why can't there be such a thing as a sole superpower that is willing to be a strong and a gentle nation? There's no other country right now that is even beginning to approach touching us in terms of weapon stockpiles. There's no other country that enjoys the ridiculous economic situation that we primarily have in this country. I know there are many people who are without in our country, but by and large, we expect to get other people's precious resources at cut-rate prices. And yet, we continue to get lulled into the belief that somehow, as Madeleine Albright puts it, if we have to use force, we must. We are the indispensable nation. We stand taller than others. We see further. Let us hope that we can move off of that Pyrrhic victory and that terrible pinnacle and begin to stand tall in our commitment to simplicity, service, sharing, and reverence for all. And let's let Ralph Nader lead us in that direction. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Ms. Kelly raises a lot of issues that people in this room are concerned about. Madeleine Albright says that we're an indispensable nation, and she extrapolates from that we can dictate around the world, mostly not in the interest of most American people, but in the interest of corporations. And I think we have a role as students, as young people, as activists. We have a role to demand, as people who live in this country, we have a role to demand that our government redefine their role in the world. And we have to start with the sanctions in Iraq and our funding of a number of dictatorships around the world.